Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 4 for November 28th, 2017. I'm Don Komarechka, the host, and I'm joined with a good buddy of mine, Alan Attridge from the Two Hosers Photo Show. How are you doing today, Alan?
I'm doing good, Don. How are you?
I am good. A little bit jet-lagged and tired from traveling to Whitehorse and back over the weekend to do a photo workshop, which was a huge success, but no downtime during that process. So I slept in today, which technically, I guess I woke up at 7 based on the time difference. But anyhow, what's new and exciting with you?
I just got back from the West Coast myself. I was in Vancouver for a job and then now back here in Germany and just finished editing that job. So
what kind of job?
Just a boring corporate job. Sounds awesome. Sounds like, you know, the jet setter life. I did pop down to Los Angeles for a day, but all in all, kind of a rather boring, well, boring to the outside. I enjoy my job, but, you know, boring to the outside people.
Yeah, and like I had a fun time doing this presentation. I do it typically once a year, my Vision Beyond Seeing Talk. And it's a day-long seminar, so about like 8 hours with a few breaks in between, followed by some back-to-back hands-on workshops. And that's tough to talk for 8 hours straight. It really takes a lot out of you. And then to go in the next day and do hands-on stuff where some people have all the equipment, some people are missing bits and pieces, and you've got to try and fill in the gaps and make sure that everybody gets a great image. There's a bit of stress in that, but at the end of the day, everybody was happy, got lots of compliments.
And how many people attend?
The hands-on one is limited to 10 per group. Okay. So that's 20 in total there. I can't stretch myself any thinner than that if I'm the only instructor. Mm-hmm. It's not fair to anybody. And then we were in a classroom that I think could seat more people than we had, but we had about 40 or 50 people there, which is pretty good based on the location. In previous times, I've done the workshop and there's been about 200 people in attendance. So that's always nice, but also intimidating.
Oh, so it's not in Whitehorse every year?
No. Last time was in Windsor. The time before was in Sarnia, both in Southern Ontario. Yeah. So we got some fun stories to talk about here, although it's been a really slow news week. So story number one, I've seen this reported all over the place, but DP Review had some of the best statistics on it. For the new Sony a7 R3, which is a fantastic camera in all rights, and I was talking about its pixel shift technology in a previous episode, but apparently it is still a star eater. And if you compare to the A7 R2, which this was a fairly big problem with, if you're an astrophotographer and you want to do a beautiful, you know, star field of the Milky Way, stars will disappear on you. At least they did in the A7 R2. And it's been shown that the same type of algorithm exists on the newer model, but only for exposures that are 4 seconds or longer. The noise reduction kicks in even on the raw data. Sony is not giving you an unfiltered raw file to deal with at the end of the day, which kind of miffs me a little bit. I'd like to have, you know, even the option, just the choice to say, hey, you know what, I know you're filtering for hot pixels and whatever it is you want to get the best user experience, but give me an advanced mode, the expert shooter mode. Uncompress everything, don't do anything with it, let me deal with it in post as I see fit. What do you think about that, Alan?
Well, what possible motivation would Sony have, or could Sony have, to not give you the raw version?
Well, if the sensor has a lot of hot pixels that really show up when right. You're doing longer exposures, then there would be a desire to filter that out to kind of hide their faults in the sensor there. But also, the majority of users, I think they're going after the best user experience here. So they're trying to, and this is why they compressed their higher megapixel RAW files as well. And there's an uncompressed mode, but it still has this problem. Because file sizes were getting just ridiculously huge, and right. And so I mean that hurts the consumer experience as well. So there are reasons why, but just like I just give it all, give everything to me, and I will deal with it as I see fit.
But see, now the way I see this, now I have zero hands on with any of the Sony cameras. I've heard they're fantastic, but this did not exist in the first version of the A7.
I don't believe so, or at least people weren't complaining about it.
Okay. And so this is one of those things, I think, to me, it's be careful what you wish for. But and it sounds like this is kind of a product of the megapixel race. In theory, the more pixels you have, the more hot pixels you will have.
Exactly.
And, you know, back in the day, which was a Thursday, FYI, if you we had 4 megapixel cameras, like people consumer cameras, you can go buy the Nikon, whatever it was called, and it had 4 megapixels. And I thought life was pretty good. I enjoyed that camera. I don't remember there being a hot pixel issue.
Neither do I. And even, you know, like I've got a print hanging on my wall that's an 80 by 20 print, and it's made from only 7 megapixels. Mm-hmm. It's a 21 megapixel image, but cropped to be a very long panorama. So there you go. And I didn't really notice any hot pixels or any issues there. But you're right. The more you add, the more problems you can potentially encounter. But in practice, this is what bothers me somewhat. In practice, when I'm looking at the actual examples of this beautiful star field of the Milky Way, if I'm missing a star or two, does it really hurt my photograph? I mean, I'm not trying to be an astrophysicist and trying to plot some new space object here. I'm just trying to get a beautiful shot of the Milky Way. And if one or two of those dots are a little bit dimmer or missing, and I'm exaggerating, it's more than that, but it still looks like the Milky Way to me. I'm not going to be able to tell the difference as a photographer and as somebody that appreciates that kind of artwork, even if it's somebody else taking the picture.
Well, in theory, could you not just add them in Photoshop?
Well, if you're the astrophysicist that can point, hey, that star is missing.
I'm not suggesting you do. That's not my domain. I like to shoot what is real and not bend that. I mean, but in theory, you could add all the stars.
In theory, I mean, you could computate. This is where computational photography could come in and say, hey, you know what? Oh, it's a photo of the Milky Way. Oh, but, you know, there's a cloud running by. Hey, you know what? I've got a map of the sky. I can just put those stars back. I can remove that cloud for you and have it authentically accurate. If we're doing some amazing things with artificial intelligence for facial recognition and what have you, that it seems reasonable that if there was a demand for it, we could do that too.
Should we?
I don't know. I don't. It's going to happen one way or another.
I'm certain it is. Well, it's funny because a lot of those pictures. I mean, a lot of travel pictures. Like just to dial it back, the way I shoot travel photos now is wildly different than I did 10 years ago. Just because I will not shoot a picture of, say, pick something like the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. I won't just shoot a bare picture because there's a few million of them already exist on Flickr from that week.
Exactly. And, you know, I hate shooting the bigger landmarks, you know, I would, you know, like I went recently to Watkins Glen in upstate New York, which is a very recognizable waterfall in this little gorge. And I took a picture of it and it was well received, but I know that that photograph is one of many millions of that exact same waterfall. Some of them probably much better than mine. So what's the point?
Mm-hmm. To go back to what Sony's doing, though, and this has sort of irked me in the digital, especially in the digital video realm, because rather than address the physical issue with the pixels themselves, they're trying to mask it with some sort of a software algorithm.
Well, exactly. And oftentimes, too, you know, the camera is going to apply some sort of built-in, Canon calls them picture styles. I'm not sure exactly what Sony calls them, but for vivid or landscape or portrait or whatever. And so it's modifying the data that's being viewed on the back of the camera. The raw file is still going to be the same. But you mentioned video, and that's key because that gets baked right into it.
Right.
And I've shot with a number of cameras for documentary films for BBC and National Geographic and what have you. And I'm shooting with the Canon 1DX Mark II, which is a phenomenal camera, and it shoots 4K video. But it doesn't give me the Canon Log Gamma, which is a duller, more RAW-like file format that has less contrast, so that the people editing the footage to do color grading and to put everything together at the end of the day can make it match properly. Now, it's not as big of a deal when you're dealing with documentary films because one scene is so drastically different from another. In your realm, Alan, when you do your video stuff, that might be important for you.
It is important. There is a way to sort of somewhat hack that and get close. You're not going to get right in. You're not going to get like a nice raw file, but I do shoot everything flat when I'm shooting for someone else like that. I've shot, I worked on a movie called The 24 Hour War, which is a documentary about Ford versus Ferrari in the 60s at Le Mans. And I was shooting second camera alongside the C300, which does shoot that Canon log that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so basically I had to make my footage be able to match up with that, with the A camera, which I did. I shot very flat. I shot on a CineStyle picture style and dialed down the sharpness, dialed down the contrast, dialed down the colors and all that. And a lot of my shots have made it in the final film, and I don't think you can tell.
Good, but you knew what you had to do when you were shooting. If you didn't take that preemptive step, then it would have been much harder after the fact to make it match, right?
Oh, that's true. Once it's dialed in like that, if I were to have shot it on just a regular, one of the regular picture styles, it would have stuck out, I think, like a sore thumb. But what I did is I did shoot a couple of test shots ahead of time, send them to the guys, the director who was shooting it, and said, hey, can you just check and see, is this what you want on the day? Like when I meet you.
And there's a lot of stuff that happens behind the scenes in our cameras that we're not necessarily aware of. You know, I remember reading a white paper a while ago that was talking about CMOS sensors and how when the light is coming in on a relatively extreme angle, that the sensor doesn't detect it as well as if it's kind of coming straight into the pot.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was interesting because that affects really wide aperture lenses. We're talking f1.4 or wider to some degree. And I did a test. I had the the Canon 85 f1.2 that I was renting for a week, and I just took a picture of a flat white wall just on the manual setting so that things would be consistent for the test. And it came off a certain shade of gray. That's fine. But then I dismounted the lens just slightly so that the lens couldn't communicate to the camera body and tell it what the aperture was set to. And interestingly enough, the second image with no communication was a touch darker. I checked the metadata on both of these photos, and the metadata is 100% identical. There's no issue there. But what it means is Canon behind the scenes is understanding that the CMOS sensor has a certain amount of fall off at f1.2 and applies some sort of an exposure adjustment to the image. Mm-hmm. For the compensation of the flaw of the sensor there as well. So I'm not just singling out Sony with this. Other companies do this to some degree as well. And I've wanted to get my hands on the Canon 50mm f1.0 lens just to do this test. And it would be really interesting to see if somebody out there has a Leica Noctilux f0.95 and can tape over whatever identifier that the camera uses to see if that lens is attached. Because who knows if all camera manufacturers are doing that as well. It'd be an interesting thing to see.
Mm-hmm. To me, that whole thing was very frustrating when it came to the sort of a jello effect that we saw on early DSLR video.
The way it was scanning, and it wouldn't handle horizontal motion at all.
Right. And the camera, my primary camera still has the jello effect. I shoot around it. I still shoot with the 5D Mark II because it works. But that one issue being the main issue for me, and the approach that a lot of people took was, well, we'll develop an algorithm like Apple did, you know, to build in a filter that will kind of get rid of that digitally in post. And I said, well, that's not really helping us.
That's a Band-Aid on a shotgun wound, really. I mean,
it is.
Sure, it looks pretty, but the problem is there.
Yeah, and that's what that's my first takeaway with this issue with Sony was, you're trying to fix something. Why don't you fix the problem? Is there a way to deal with the hot pixel problem?
Possibly, and maybe they'll roll out with a fix in firmware that gives us everything, and then we can deal with it ourselves. Mm-hmm. Sony is the biggest sensor manufacturer, as far as I know. And I mean, they're in so many different cameras and industrial uses and everything else. So actually, a good parallel to this, Alan, would be the computer monitors. Like, I've got a 4K display right here, and I don't have a single dead or any pixel that's behaving incorrectly on this size, on this scale. So
as far as you know.
as far as I know. Now, this has been an issue in the past where monitors would have dead pixels, and mm-hmm. there was even a policy from a lot of manufacturers where, you know, if you have, say, more than 8 of them in a cluster, then we'll repair it. But if the 8 of them are spread across the screen, then you're fine. That's within our tolerances, and you get what you get. But yeah, just that has been improved.
I remembered having with my thumbnail rubbing it, you know, because sometimes that would bring it back to life. It would be stuck. It wouldn't be a dead pixel. It would be a stuck pixel, and you could do that, and somehow it would work. And then you know, I guess all the ones around it would then be dead.
Don't do that with your camera sensor.
Or do it and let us know how it goes. Yeah. Send your messages to Don.
No, definitely to the Two Hosers Photo Show at that point. So the technology improves, but it's kind of two steps forward, one step back in a lot of ways. And hey, we shouldn't complain. We're far better off now than we've ever been in the past.
That's true.
Yeah. So next story is something a little bit off the path for us because it was a slow news week, but I think it's really important to talk about. It's, again, been covered everywhere on mainstream media as well. The footage of a North Korean soldier defecting to South Korea that is caught on what really is just security camera video, but it depicts something really important that I think we're losing a lot of in society today, and that's journalism, in a sense. Like, this is a documentary of what is happening. If that camera wasn't rolling, then the story of that soldier defecting and his story that I'm sure that he will tell would not be seen or heard by anybody. And to have that kind of footage is really important. And that kind of comes on the coattails of a story that is sort of local to us here in Canada, where there has been a huge number of community newspapers that are scheduled to be shut down in the very, very near future. All across the country, there was a swap of I'm not even sure why this happens, but Torstar and Post Media decided to swap a bunch of papers around and then close a bunch of them. I'm not sure mm-hmm. if that what the reason for that is, but there's at least one in Vancouver closed down. My local Barrie Examiner is being shuttered. And so all of these journalists are just disappearing on a local stage, but this echoes to a global stage just the same way. What are your thoughts on that, Alan?
I don't know who to blame. I mean, I think you wanted to talk about video. I think video kind of killed the newspaper star here. I think newspapers forgot who they were and tried to play the game that they shouldn't be playing. That's how I felt for a long time. Where there was the transition from print to online, which I think was, you know, scary for everybody, and no one knew how to handle that. For me, it was great because, you know, 10 years ago, I moved from Vancouver over to Germany, but obviously I'm not going to get the Vancouver province at my local newsstand here in Germany. That's not going to happen.
Right. But at the same time, you know, you think about, I've got a small little newspaper that I have no idea how many they produce. I get it from my mother-in-law who speaks Bulgarian and my wife as well. It's a Bulgarian newspaper that is for Bulgarians in Canada, published about issues in this country in that language. Right. And it's free. I go into the local European food store and I just pick up a copy. And so there's a market for those niches. That still exists. But it doesn't, like, I guess we just don't care in our local communities. I mean, the global sensational news that hits everything on Twitter and every social media platform is what garners all of the attention. And it's also what all of the big news organizations simply regurgitate. That's all they're talking about anymore these days. You know, the comments and the commentary on Twitter, thanks to a few notable politicians, of course. But, you know, you look at the actual hardcore investigative journalism, there's a few companies still out there doing that, and hats off to them. But for the most part, if I look at the newspaper today, I just see what I saw on Twitter. And yes, I'm not just talking about in print. I'm also talking about on any of their websites, because there's been no money. I was filmed recently for an episode or a segment on the local news on CTV Barrie, and it was syndicated, I think, at least across the province. The guy that interviewed me, great guy, Casey Colby, he was the cameraman as well as the interviewer. I mean, he was a one man show, but they all are these days. It's not like you've got the second person for the camera and a third person for the audio to do this stuff on an offsite. The budgets are so slim that there's no money to do it right anymore.
And this is a major problem. But again, this was sort of, this started with the newspapers especially. I happen to love news. I wish I could get the Vancouver Pro, or maybe the Vancouver Sun, let's be honest. But I would like to get that daily. I really enjoy reading the newspaper. So for me, the online stuff was great because I can still keep up with what's going on in Vancouver, you know, daily. But when I'm in Vancouver, I do like the newspaper. I don't even know if it exists anymore. But what ended up happening, or even my local paper, the Richmond Review, which is no longer exists anymore. It went away. You know, and
the Garson Gazette from when I was growing up, no longer. Yeah,
we're going to start sharing clippings in a minute of who. Okay, how many? What were you in for that week? And so, I really like seeing that. But at one point, when the newspapers went online, somebody had the great idea that while people are coming here to read, we also have to give them video. They don't just want to read, they want video, which I think is false.
I think it is too, you know, especially when I'm just, you know, being quiet by myself, like sitting on a bus somewhere and I'm just, you know, scrolling through news stories. I'm reading them. There's a video. I'm not going to watch it. I mean, yes. I'm not going to go rummage through my bag, put in headphones and listen to this video or do it aloud and annoy the people next to me, especially in a mobile world. Maybe I'm the outlier, but I just read the content. But we're talking about, of course, the reading, the photos are very important as well. And I think there is a certain level of sort of social coverage where if people are in a conflict zone, they've got a cell phone, they've got a camera and they can share that. But there's very little in the way of substantiating and potentially removing bias. I think it's long gone the days of photos where, you know, you've got Tank Man or Napalm Girl or a lot of the right. Very famous. I can name these photographs and you can picture them in your head.
I just did.
Yeah. And so that era is gone. But along with it was the high quality investigative journalism that carried that forward, that made those images worthwhile.
But how many photojournalists were in, let's say, covered the Vietnam War in country?
I don't know an exact number, but it wasn't a lot.
Compared to how many quote unquote photographers, people with smartphones, people with whatever, are currently in Syria, for example.
Oh, tons. Oh, absolutely. So it has shifted to the citizen. And that I think is very valuable, very empowering. But if you don't have the narrative behind the photograph to carry that forward, which is where the journalists, at least a journalist like from Canada or the United States, to take those images, put them into context, you know, play both sides of the coin to just kind of say, okay, well, this is why they're fighting. This is why the other people are fighting back. And for us to understand and get the facts instead of just having some sort of biased opinion with the photos. Now, it's important to state that, you know, I forget the name of the photo. It was the one with the vulture that was next to a small malnourished child. Mm-hmm. Little do you know, when you look at the photograph, it looks like the vulture is about to consume the child that is still alive. But they were at like some sort of UN aid area and they were receiving aid. And the parents were making a better life for that child and getting food to feed them. But it wasn't framed that way.
Right.
The photograph itself told a vastly different story. And it was so vastly criticized that sadly, the photographer that took the picture committed suicide. As journalists and as people that every day consume media, we are being inundated by opinions and biases all over the place. And it's becoming harder to form our own opinion by seeing the whole picture.
The biases, yeah, definitely play a major role. But also, I find that with just the complete sea, like just the mass of different media coming at us, it's hard to find out. Like this video of the Korean, North Korean defector, is it shocking? It should be wildly shocking. It should have been all over the news since it happened, what, 2 weeks ago. Yeah. And it's received a smattering, and then it's, you know, oh, well, something else happened.
Well, because we're all somewhat tone deaf to it now. We get numb to the sensational news if that's all we ever receive. And with the current political climate in the United States, there are so many shocking news stories constantly, almost every day. Right. And it's just, oh, well, you know, that happened. Oh, volcano erupting in Bali right now? Huh, okay.
Yeah, the end.
Move on.
That is part of the very fast cycle. But also without having anyone to edit, like if you were to sit down and just watch all the dailies back to back and spend the next, you know, a few days watching all the dailies of ET, you wouldn't be very entertained.
No, you wouldn't.
But somebody went and took that. A very responsible editor went and took that and shaped that into the narrative that you see. And it's a great movie. The news kind of requires that. Now, not to shape it into the bias that you're talking about, but to basically get rid of all the background noise so that the important bits can be seen, so that we can digest those important parts. And
exactly.
We don't get to. And so ironically, again, this is kind of the theme is be careful what you wish for. Everyone's got phones. Everything's being taped. Everything's being not taped. I hate to use that. That's the old man tip off. Yeah. Everything's being recorded. And so, therefore, if you have everything, you have nothing.
Yep. Yeah. It's just white noise.
And unfortunately, and that's why when you know, you say that, like, this you know, the CCTV footage of this North Korean defector should be iconic. It won't be.
Yeah. But also, you know, one of the reasons why I think that the local news media is disappearing is how often across your Twitter stream or your Facebook stream are you getting relevant local news from the people that you're following? I mean, aside from, oh, there's a poorly constructed birthday cake, or wow, that's a lot of snow in your driveway.
That's a good point. From peers, yes. I don't really pay much attention to those people, but I actually do. I do follow a local, well, not local. He's from British Columbia, but local from where I'm from. I follow a local reporter on Twitter. I used to play baseball with the guy too.
And what if he's out of a job? Right? Is he now going to be a social media reporter? No, he's going to go.
No.
You know, find some other job to pay the bills.
Yes. Okay, but how do we fix that?
Well, no, we're just here to complain about it. We're not here to fix it.
No, correct. We can't fix it.
There's nothing we can do.
That ship has sailed. But every time a door closes like this, there has to be a new opportunity, which I think I think for me, the silver lining of watching the sort of circus that's going on right now in the social media and the political realm. The silver lining has to be that they are breaking the system so much that they're going to be forced to start again. I hope.
Yeah. Scorched earth, right?
I suppose maybe this is rock bottom. And now we have to say, look, we can't do this anymore.
I think rock bottom is yet to come, unfortunately. And so we're going to see where this takes us.
It's coming up soon. February, probably. Super Bowl.
Yeah, could be.
In and around then, I think we're going to see it. But what happens? How can, if the money isn't there, how can they send a crew of three? Now, I've been a one-man gang before on all the time for video projects.
It's you look at certain. There are certain subsidies that the government provides to magazines, for example, to help afford the publication and the distribution and all that. But I don't necessarily want the government to be funding my news. There has to be a very clear line. You know, some sort of
news
very
for profit.
Rich billionaire that wants to own own all the magazines, and then it's all his opinion. I mean, it's
Conrad Black.
Yeah, but
to name names. Are we naming names?
Well, you just did, but
yeah.
The point is that, you know, if Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk wanted to,
he does.
Well, I know, and that's what I'm getting at. All of these rich guys. Well, Elon Musk, I don't think owns a newspaper, but he could, and I would probably read it because I like his point of view. But that's not to say that his point of view is not biased, and to have unbiased media is something that my daughter, who's 17 months old right now, I don't think she'll ever see.
Well, I think. Was Randolph Hearst not biased? with the Rosebud and the whole thing there? That was...
Sure. Everybody is biased. I shouldn't state unbiased, but less biased.
But now what happens, I take a certain amount of pride in being Canadian, but to do with the CBC. And I this could be me being naive, but I kind of hope that the CBC is relatively unbiased.
I agree. And if you've ever listened to CBC Radio 1, they're rather well-structured to remove opinions from a lot of their conversations. It's facts. It's stating very objective things. And then occasionally when they're doing an interview, that's where the subjective stuff comes in. But they do a pretty good job of it. But I'm not saying that... I guess what I'm trying to say is I have no words. I have no words for how this is going to move forward and make the world a better place for us to get the proper news without getting it from somebody who heard it from somebody or with very specific biases for or against my opinion.
It's on us. It's unfortunately, it is on us. We can never blame the newspapers because... You know, the basic, how do newspapers function? How does the Barry Examiner, is that right?
Yeah, advertising.
Is that what you said? Advertising.
Advertising and paid, it was a paid subscription. So right. You would have to pay like a buck for the paper or whatever it was. But most of the newspapers, at least the small community ones, were freely distributed. Like we've got the Barry Advance that it arrives on my door every day, loaded, like just caked, I should say every week. With flyers and advertising, yes. I'm going to say 90% of it is ad material,
mostly Best Buy
and the local real estate agents.
Exactly, but that's how it functions. And without that money, if people aren't going to read it, if they're not interested, then the advertisers are going to say, "Well, we're not getting eyeballs." You know, where we can get eyeballs, we can get eyeballs on clickbait. We can do that, and in the end, that's what advertisers want. And so. It's on us to say, no, we kind of need this. We need to find out what's going on. We need to find out who's defecting from North Korea and who's coming out of South Guelph. We have to find out who's doing that.
Exactly. So is this going to be a career shift for you, Alan?
For me, no. I mean, in terms of what I choose to, and I hate using this word, but it's the word consume, I'd like to think I'm better than the cycle. Which is kind of an egotistical thing to say, I suppose, or arrogant. But I try not to pay attention to the nonsense out there.
Yep.
I urge everybody else, turn it off. It is absolute nonsense. I don't care if it's you're on the CNN side or the Fox News side. If you look objectively, which I think we can do, this is one of the other benefits of being Canadian, in my opinion, is that I feel like I can look at what's going on south of the border objectively.
We can see it from afar and see all the moving parts and how they're all kind of intertwining and where the sides are and where the lines are drawn.
Yeah. And I look at it and I see both sides. Both sides are the issue. It's not one or the other. It's just silliness. It's one bad act is supposed to balance out the other bad act, and that's what's happening.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, well, sorry, but, finish your thought.
No, but we have to stop. Stop it. Stop clicking on it. Stop doing it. And that's not going to happen. Clicking is shiny.
We have figured out ever since like propaganda during wartime and things like that, exactly how to motivate and influence and psychologically manipulate people. And that's what the news is doing.
It's outrage. So, outrage is the new currency. Exactly. I didn't think we were going to go down this road on the Geek Photo Geek Weekly, because we can't photograph outrage. Maybe we can. We try. This is the issue. Is outrage sells. So what I'm telling you, dear listener, don't be outraged anymore. It's silly.
Yep.
The end. End of sermon.
The end.
I'll get off my soapbox and we'll talk about geek stuff.
Yeah, well, there's one more note, and it was announced earlier, but I wanted to bring this back up because we haven't talked about it, and it's been silent since, but Red Cameras, which yes. I know you're familiar with, they've got this idea for a smartphone, and it's called the Red Hydrogen.
Right.
And this is a really interesting idea, but one that is still very vague in the details. Basically, what they're saying that it is a multi-dimensional capture and recording device. So they say holographic, although I doubt that technology exists. They might be using the wrong term there. But how interesting would it be, Alan, if you could have a cell phone, and maybe this becomes ubiquitous at some point in the future, that could record in either stereoscopic or in some sort of holographic way, and then display that back to you in 3D and having the screen have some level of depth to it. Would you be interested in that?
No, not in the least.
No, not at all.
No, no. But remember who you're talking to. I'm that guy. I'm that guy at the party who likes to announce, I don't have a smartphone, you know? So I don't have a cell phone now. And they've existed.
You are an anachronism. That's what you are.
On purpose. I get them. I understand them. Can't stand them. But I have an iPod. I have an iPad. I live, you know, I'm not a, what's the word for those? I can't think of the name of the people who just hate technology. I'm not that guy.
A Luddite.
That's the one. I'm not that. Obviously, I'm here. I'm talking to you over the internets via, you know, from Germany. So I love podcasts. I love everything that in that realm. What I don't like is I don't like having it when I'm out. I like being out.
Yeah. And like I just got back from the Yukon, and while I was connected in the city, previous visits up there were 3 weeks in the wilderness. Yes. And after like 2 or 3 days, the withdrawal symptoms start to fade because mm-hmm. I'm just instinctively grabbing my phone to see what's new. It's, oh yeah, I haven't had an internet connection in a day. And then once it goes away, man, there is a sense of serenity and peace of mind that you cannot get when you are connected. So I understand yes. where you are. I've got the addiction to being always connected, and yes. And so it shall be.
I do understand it. I mean, I had a cell phone at one point. It was a flip phone, so that tells you how long ago it was. It's been over 10 years since I've had one. And so, or I'll go on vacation and be off, you know, off the grid, like I'm Jason Bourne or something, but be off there. And there's still a little withdrawal because, you know, I have Wi-Fi at my house, of course, or at many coffee shops and whatnot. But being able to go away from it, like when you're out somewhere, is wildly freeing. And, you know, I do get burned. I get burned 99 times out of 100. Life is great. Like you're just, it's zen, it's awesome. That one time you really get burned by not having a phone.
Well, and in this particular case, this technology is really interesting for me because it kind of goes on to the journalism talk that we just mentioned, is what if, and this is a big what if, because Red is making a prototype here that is ridiculously expensive, mm-hmm. That they're going to sell a dozen of. I have no idea. It's not going to be a high production phone because nobody's hearing about it. It's not like it's coming from Samsung or Apple. But if the technology does exist, and there have been some 3D phones in the past that were pretty poorly made, but I don't think Red's going to cut any corners here. If the public perception could be that you could see a photograph in three dimensions, or that somehow it could capture video in 3D and you could play that back, it really brings back the sense of realism and being there. Just like during like World War I, stereoscopic mm-hmm. photography was big because that was before TV and in many cases before radio. And in that sense, you know, if you wanted to see what was going on, you could get a picture or you could see it in 3D and get a real sense like you're almost there. And this was, of course, before commercial air travel. And you wanted to see Egypt or the Eiffel Tower. Well, you could get stereo views of that. Mm-hmm. But today, you know, if you could bring a sense of it being in 3D, maybe even 360 degree in stereo, wouldn't that be wonderful? I have no idea how that tech exists, but you could have that sort of point of view that presents itself with less bias. The more information you have, I think the less bias you're going to encounter. Now, 3D photography is nothing new, but depending on how they roll this out, this could help in telling the true story.
It definitely sounds amazing, and I'm not one for stifling technology just because I disagree with it, of course. But it's one of those things where will it catch on? Remember when you were a kid? When you were a kid, did you have internet? I did not have internet.
Oh, well, I remember the very first time we had internet was like from one of those AOL CDs, which was a disc at the time, actually.
Right, okay.
And I was able to download half a picture of Spider-Man. Now, that is my first internet activity. And then we didn't have internet again for 5 years after that.
Right. But see, for me, the when I was a kid, I remember being like, you know, like 11 years old, and there's the promise of, you know, one day there's going to be video telephones. And I thought that would be amazing, mostly for prank phone calls, would be awesome. But I thought, wow, could you imagine? You'd see the person like they do on the TV. We have that now. I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah. The Star Trek big viewer on the Enterprise to see who was in the opposing ship and all of that. Yeah, it's sure. It's here now. Is anybody just, you know, running around and giddy about it? No, nah, it's on more of an annoyance.
I mean, my kids talk to their grandparents and their aunties and whatnot via FaceTime. In that respect, I kind of like it. I like the technology going. Yeah. I would imagine you're in the exact same position. But just in terms of, you know, you're going to call your buddy to go, you know, play poker or something like that. Do you call him on the video?
No. I might not even call him.
Well, there you go. Now it's texting, of course. But you know, there will be applications for something like this. Like you said, you want to go see the Eiffel Tower or I could imagine this being going even further. And it, you know, this would be something that they're going to hardwire into someone's brain and that can't see. And now all of a sudden someone who's physically blind can now explore, you know, in North America can now explore the Eiffel Tower. This is amazing stuff.
Yeah, well, here's a thought. Like my grandfather, he's diabetic and his legs are really giving out on him. And so he uses a walker and a scooter and things like that. But they came to visit us last summer and I wanted to show him my workshop and my studio, but it was down the stairs and he could not get down the stairs. So he did not get to see it. But I took my wife's phone. I did a FaceTime connection between our two phones, handed the one phone to him, and I walked around the house to show him the mm-hmm. stuff that he couldn't see. There are a lot of uses for that technology, and I'm glad that it exists. I don't know in our generation if it's going to be a pervasive norm. But for people like our children that are growing up with this in their hands right now through their formative years, I think it's going to be a changer in the way that we communicate.
I believe so too. My daughter's only 6 years old. She already has friends who have smartphones, even here in Germany. And so I'm trying to basically, you know, indoctrinate her with the smartphones are evil, which so far so good. But
good luck with that.
When she's 7, yeah. It's game over, I'm sure. But in terms of this, I saw the price on the hydrogen. Weren't they advertising something in the $1,500?
$1,500. No, you did not misread that. It's
but what's
one of
the
most expensive.
What's the iPhone X cost?
About $1,000, you know? So, you know, it's okay. Not too far off. In like, if you're going to be spending $1,000 on a phone, what's a couple of $100 more? And it's by no means the most expensive phone. There's these weird luxury diamond crusted ones that will sell for more than my car is worth.
Right. That's silliness, but from, you know, looking at the specs, it's saying it's a titanium phone. That's worth $1,500.
They have one in aluminum as well, but the titanium is, I guess it's got the extra allure.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. Titanium. So in that respect, I didn't find the price to be unwieldy, you know, considering what smartphones do cost. I'm aware of them. I just don't, you know, myself.
All right. Well, that technology is on the horizon, and it's one of the things that I wanted to bring up to listeners of this podcast. It is a phone that, if I could get my hands on one at a reasonable price, I certainly would. I don't. I've got an iPhone 6, and it still works perfectly fine for me until it just completely gives up. I'm not going to be buying a new one, and then I'll look and see what the new tech is. But having new technology to view the world and to share your point of view more accurately, I think is good for all of us.
I agree.
All right. Alan, this has been a great chat. Before we end the call and wrap things up, what's next on the horizon for you? What big ideas do you have?
Oh, can I even talk about them? A few ideas. That's why I was in Los Angeles. So a few ideas I want to work on. Probably going to play a little closer to the vest than announce it here, but I'll check back with you.
All right.
In the upcoming months, I have a few projects in the works that I kind of want to get going, kind of like globally, which is kind of nice. One of the kind of real benefits of being an expat, being a guy from Vancouver, living here in Germany and having connections in entertainment in Los Angeles, you can kind of think on a much larger, not a larger scale, but just sort of outside the normal box of production. And right. There's a lot of downside to it, a lot of downside to living over here, but a lot of upside as well that I kind of want to exploit. Does that clear anything up?
No. Well, hey, you've got big things on the horizon that you can't talk about. I got a few of those too. So, but where can people find you and the Two Hosers Photo Show, which I've been on a number of times, and it's a great program.
You're our first guest.
I was the first guest, yeah.
Very first guest.
I'm the honorary third hoser.
You pretty much are, yeah, yeah. Well, like to keep it Canadian. And no, Two Hosers Photo Show, that's at twohosers.com, where Adam and I, my co-host, we learn something new every week. Just a little background on the show. Adam, seven years ago, Adam bought his first DSLR. He's a physiotherapist and wanted me to tell him how to take pictures. And he didn't know how to open the box barely. And so I said, you know what? I will tell you, but we'll record it every week. We'll learn something new every week. The listeners will come along. And now he actually works as a professional photographer, part-time.
He's fantastic. And the listeners are starting to grow here, which is great to see. So maybe I'll put a link into the show notes of one of the episodes that I've been on for the Two Hosers. We've had some great conversations over the years. And you can find us here if you're listening to it through iTunes. All the show notes are on photogeekweekly.com. And we have a little Patreon link there if you want to support us and get new content and better shows and better production.
Better guests,
yeah, better than this Alan guy, then there's a link for that as well, and we certainly appreciate all of your support. So without further ado, enough listening to us, get out and shoot.